Hi, this is The Conversation, and this is Michael Shaw. Coming up, my conversation with Deborah Grant. It's the first full-length conversation with a New York artist, one of the last artists under 50, apparently, living in Manhattan. So stay tuned for that. I want to thank Steve Turner for introducing me to Deborah Grant. You can listen to a few of my other conversations with Steve Turner artists by going to the Conversation Artist Podcast.podomatic.com. You will find another 35 or 40 conversations there. I hope to be speaking with more New York artists, so if you are in New York, please spread the word about this podcast. I also am expanding this podcast to speak with curators, dealers, and possibly collectors as well, depending on how receptive that crowd is. So we'll see how that goes. When you're at the Conversation Artist Podcast.podomatic.com, you can also find a PayPal donation button there. Donations are very much appreciated for this show to keep it going. You can also be supportive in spirit by going to the Facebook fan page, The Conversation Artist Podcast on Facebook. You can also follow on Twitter. And that's about it. Let's get to my conversation with Deborah Grant. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you very much for listening, and I will talk to you soon. Ciao.
So much bravery.
When was this work completed for this show?
As of 2012. In fact, right up to this past January. And it finally was completed, and it took roughly from the time of reading the two texts, which was Homecoming by Richard Powell and Truth Be Told by Steve Turner and Victoria Daly, it was probably about a year and a half of working, almost 2 years, of working on the project and kind of dissecting what I wanted to take from the texts and then also what I wanted to put together in terms of telling the story, in terms of the painting. Because I never want texts and dialogue from a book to become off, like the work becomes the book.
Right.
And I want to kind of put my own twist on it. So it's always, it's that feeling to just go through the sort of all the parts, including the smaller minutiae parts, which basically can basically tell the real story about what had happened to him or happened to her, depending on who I'm looking at. And I prefer to look at appropriation in the process. And I like looking at the idea of appropriating and looking through there, because I feel like we're not always, you don't always find your hand. You know, that hand when you're looking through the process of painting. And I feel like there's a way of not creating, recreating the wheel, but actually adding a spoke maybe to the wheel if you can.
Okay, let's be for practicality's sake,
okay.
what I was wondering is if you had a chance to see this show before it was installed at all?
No, I wasn't able
So this is the first time you've sort of seen
it? In fact,
it.
That's usually what happens, because I have a small space.
Okay.
So it's
you're in
like,
Harlem, as
yeah,
we talked
exactly.
about. Yeah,
exactly.
Now, you're one of the few surviving artists who still has a studio in the city, right?
The studio now is in my home, so...
It's a loft sort of space, or is it an apartment slash studio?
No, it's apartment slash studio.
Okay.
So basically
is
I work
pretty
between...
Intimate?
It's pretty intimate, but yeah. I like it, because in the past I used to work on canvases, and I would roll them up at one end and then just work, and I'd never see the work up full. So then when I got a chance to see the work, it was like... Oh, I can do this. You know, I can work this way and not worry. So I have one big, about sort of like 15-foot wall that I can have for everything to put up.
Mm-hmm.
And
is that essentially your living room?
Essentially the living room. That's the studio. The living room is the studio.
Right.
So that's sort of how I'm able to kind of come together with putting the works together. But I don't get to see them for the first time. It's only when they're put up in a gallery space or if it's in a group show at a museum or something like that I begin to...
Right. Well, the longer of the two panels that you have in this show, and we should mention it's called The Provenance of and Crowning of King William.
Uh-huh.
And I'm talking with Deborah Grant, and we're in the back room at Steve Turner's, where your show is going to open a second. And by the way, I have talked to another New York artist, but it was only a guy named Zephyr Throwell who did a project in LA that he was in town for, but it wasn't a full-scale conversation. So this is the first New York full-scale conversation.
I'm honored.
I am as well. Thank you for being here. So what I was going to ask then is, the longer of these two panels you have out here is what, like 12 feet? 10 feet?
About 16 feet for the big painting.
Oh, 16. Okay.
Yeah, 16.
So clearly
Yeah.
You had to work on that at most half or maybe three quarters in your space.
Yeah, because
is that right?
I have four separate panels that come together to make the full painting itself. Okay. So it's easy to sort of take the one panel, lay it on top of a table. I have these 2 8-foot banquet tables that I have. I just sort of have them together and I mount them together and wrap them with cellophane and then put brown paper on top. And then from there, take the painting and work directly on top of those tables.
Right.
So it makes it easy to move around and move the painting around, much to work.
Now, I'm interested in people's working situations. Most of the interviews that I have done are at people's studios. Mm-hmm. So how – now, I spoke to a woman, her name's Heather Brown, who lives in an apartment in Koreatown, and her essentially her living room is her studio, and it's so it's intimate to the point where she can lie in her bed basically and look at the larger paintings that she's working on. You know,
I hear
she,
you.
She says she calls it like TV, you know, because it's like
that's you know, right. I can sit there.
Yeah. So the question then for you is, do you appreciate more the fact that you have that kind of regular intimate encounter, or on the other hand, at a certain point, do you feel like I really need to get some space?
I had space at one particular point, but the rents went up so much that it was inevitable that I had to move, and I had to adjust everything down to having it into sections. So the idea of working within sections made it easier as compared to trying to work in terms of a big canvas and a big space or knocking down walls or any of that thing that some people have done in their studios. But I think there's a majority of artists who are doing that right now. Plus, you're seeing what's happening over in the Lower East Side. There's not the amount of space that there used to be in Chelsea. The number of galleries left Chelsea because of the high rents and then the crash. And you sort of see this transformation happening with artists where they're working a lot more intimately. And so I went back to working intimately for the fact of losing my studio and realizing that I needed to just focus in on the work as I could do it and do it in terms of not the principle of filling the gallery.
Right.
But thinking out ideas thoroughly, and usually out of the year to 2 years that I'm given, then I'm able to be able to figure out that I'm able to get a lot of work done, even if it's an intimate setting of the fact that I could sit in my bed and do it in my bedroom if I want to, or go out to the front room and work and keep working. I could listen to the radio, watch television, or whatever.
Right.
And basically, you know, that'd be like background noise to the relationship of completely working. I'm working on ideas. So.
It sounds like what I'm getting from the way you're describing it is that, and also just from seeing your work up now, is that you have this, once you start a project, you have this intimacy with it.
Right.
So that, say, an abstract painter, for example, who's working in a intuitive format where, you know, maybe they get stuck and they need to kind of like get away from it or put it away and then come back to it so they can see it fresh.
Right.
So it's not, it sounds like it's not that much of an issue for you because you have these sort of formats, these structures and these patterns that you kind of work in, particularly with this sort of calligraphy of this, you know, fictional language or languages that you use that where you sort of just kind of get into it and it's not going to benefit you to sort of go away from it and then come back because the more time you can spend on it, the better.
The better. And the fact that it's that free association and even in the act of making a mistake, it's like how you define the mistake. And then it's like just redeveloping ideas over and over and over again. And I think I started from my bedroom when I first moved to New York. From college, I had only a bedroom to work in, and it was very tiny. And I would work on, I had one wall that was about 9 feet, and that's as big as the canvas I could get to work on. So I would go down to like Pearl Art Supply, and they have those bins full of, you know, uneven canvases and rice paper and stuff like that. And I would use that and basically make pieces. And initially, I was doing these long rice paper pieces. And sort of doing the rice paper pieces allowed me to roll them up and work, and they could grow, you know, up to, you know, 30 feet. But they were a nice size roll of paper, which would be, you know, and in height, 8.5 by 8.5 by maybe 11 inches in height, and then the rest would be about 30 feet.
Right.
So it was just being able to work through and work out ideas and work around.
There is this certain paradox or this tension between being limited to a certain amount of small space. Mm-hmm. You know, which on one hand would make you think, okay, I'm going to just work small. I'm going to work like, you know, on two or maximum 3 foot panels or something like that. And yet you're working big. So it's kind of like, I'm not going to let my limited studio limit the size of my project.
Right. And in fact, even if I have just opposed the position of the pieces where one's on one wall, one's connecting to another wall. Mm-hmm. I'm not able to see it all up, but when I do see it all, it surprises me.
Yeah.
So it's like walking in here when I got to LA and I was able to come and see the installation. I was surprised. I was shocked because it looked great to me because I could never really visualize it in my space.
Right.
But I've never let that be the limitations to what I want to do in terms of making pieces. I mean, I can't do a massive I could, but it'd be a number of panels just piled up in my space in which to do the
right
a really massive painting.
It's kind of like you have to trust in that the part is going, if the part does its job, the whole will then do its job in turn, something along those lines.
I agree. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, I feel like, you know, before we maybe get into talking specifically about this project that you have up, I'm interested in, I keep the buzzword that keeps coming up, which sort of is where your work started, I guess, to presumably become known, was this freestyle show that happened. Was it 2000?
It was 2001.
2001. Yeah. Okay. That it was at the Studio Museum.
It's April 2001. Yeah.
Okay. Got it. And I didn't see that show. I should have seen that show, but certainly it lives on as, you know, this very important show that happened. Mm. And, you know, a lot of big artists were in it / came out of it. Mm. Tell me about how you sort of hooked up with Thelma Golden and, you know, kind of what that process was like.
Well, the process happened where I actually met Christine Kim, who's now at LACMA. And Christine Kim...
Who's right across the street.
Right across the street, correct. And I met with her at the Bronx Museum's thing that they had called the Access Zone. And you could take in your slides at that particular... Everyone had slides. This is still back in 2001. And taking your slides or your disc, and you could show it to a New York curator. So I showed Christine the work, and she really liked it. She said, I'd like to see what you're going to have done by the end of the summer. I'd like to be able to come back and take a look. So that's when she came by, and she came to my bedroom when I was living in Harlem on Fifth Avenue. And I was just, when she came, she told me that they were working on a community show. She didn't go to all the logistics of what the show was about and who was going to be in it. But she said, you know, please keep me informed of everything. And when she saw the work, she liked what she saw. She then asked me if I could take some images of the works, and I told her that I have to usually take them all the way down to Soho and have a photographer shoot them, but I couldn't. Well, I had a limited point of time in which to have them ready. So she said, she talked to Thelma Golden, and Thelma Golden said, just take Polaroids. So Thelma chose works based off of Polaroids, which I always thought was amazing. And she did this phenomenal show. It was kind of her inaugural show as well, because it was her first becoming the first assistant director at the museum. She's now director at the museum. But it was just sort of seeing that transformation of how they kind of brought us in and let us know about the freestyle. It wasn't the idea that it was going to be such a big deal. It wasn't until they asked us to do something for Vibe magazine that we all got an understanding through this for this photo shoot that we ended up doing. And it was a transformation for me, for sure, as an artist, because I had no play at all when I got there. I was fresh out of college, and it was just sort of trying to figure out, you know, how to fit into this system. But I knew that the Studio Museum, what I did understand was the Studio Museum was the focal point, and the focal point would be to try and get into the Artists in Residence program. So the Artists in Residence program became important to the process of also freestyle, and freestyle just became a really important show. And you were talking 11 years later, and so many different artists have transformed into the stratosphere in their work. Mark Bradford, Julie Marutu, Corey Newkirk, Kierlin Harris. You know, you named the different artists who were in that first show.
Yeah, it's interesting you use the word community, or maybe Christine Kim,
yes,
used the word community. So when you say community, are you referring to, because you were in Harlem at the time, but not all of the artists in the show were living
in
Harlem.
No, they were all living in Harlem. Some were living here in California, and some were living... But she presented it as a community show. So she didn't go into all the logistics, which I liked. I liked the fact that it was sort of kept in such a way that we were kind of revealed information based on the letters that we got from the museum letting us know, oh, please show up here for this event. Please come for this. And then you got a sense that they were presenting you on a platform which was presenting you to the New York art world. And I think their transition on how they did it with us was very lucrative in terms of being able to get us to stay grounded in the mix of being able to be presented to the New York art world. So I like that. I like that they did it that way as compared to just sort of trying to let us know, you have to understand how big this is. You know,
right.
They didn't do that, you know.
Well, they probably didn't. They didn't necessarily know
they knew how big it was going to grow into. I don't think they knew that post-Black would be a conversation dialogue in most universities across this country. You know, it was a conversation between Glenn Ligon and Thelma Golden at that particular time.
Who coined the term?
Robert Ferris Thompson did actually coin the term post-Black.
Yeah.
He coined that term. And I don't have all the
logistics. Did he do it in an article?
He did it in one of his pieces, one of his books. I think it's Robert Ferris Thompson's Fire something. I'm not sure. You'd have to check up on that for me.
Sure.
But basically, he developed that term. But it was Thelma and Glenn that wanted to look at post-Black in the context of it being post-identity politics work and then post-minimalism, into this conversation, which would be post-Black, which artists who would look at all ideas, whether it be minimalism, whether it be conceptual-based art, whether it be abstraction, whether it be figurative, didn't matter what the context. So that's what they were bringing together. They were bringing all of us together in a mix. And in a weird way, we've become close friends in a weird way in that process. I mean, I still know a lot of the artists. I still support them in terms of going to their shows and their support of coming to my shows. It's just been a good feel from that experience. I mean, that was the most positive experience that I remember, which is freestyle.
How would you, since it wasn't literally a community, from the same community,
right?
Would you then just describe the selection process of the artist as that term, post-Black?
Or right.
Is that kind of the simplest way to put it?
I think so, because I was completely unknown. You know, I was not even on the radar.
And there were other artists in the show who probably weren't on the radar. Too.
Exactly. Yeah. Lewis Cameron, Jenny C. Jones, myself, Tanya Hargis, a number of different artists who were not.
How many artists were in the show?
There were 30 of us, if I remember. Mm-hmm. There were 30 of us in total.
Right. It's interesting to have a show where there is inherently such a, not inclusiveness, but so inherently connectedness, I think, in the artists. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's certainly the way it comes off. There's a certain arbitrariness to it on one hand, but because there was sort of a building excitement, or maybe because it ended up turning into something that became this sort of historic moment, in a sense, that bonded you guys in a way. But did you feel either at the time or since then, the connectedness, do you think, because of the work, because of the occasion, you know what I'm saying?
In terms of this people who we met, or...
Who you were grouped with in this show, and like these people who you didn't meet. You know what I mean? I mean, there's what I'm getting at is with art, when you're put in a group show, people's work there may be like five people in a group show and their work has a certain commonality.
Right.
Maybe it has a certain spiritual or, a kind of deeper connection or something like that. But the artists themselves don't necessarily have that connection. And yet with this show, it feels like there certainly was one. And I just want you to kind of tell me about, characterize how that felt for you.
I think we all came from a sort of economic social makeup to some degree, from middle class to poor. And I think that there was just this level of meeting new people and meeting this new process that we had no idea that where it was going to be taken off to. And in terms of being able to be presented to, major galleries and to be presented to major institutions and those people who are curators at these institutions, that was the grouping in terms of when they chose to select certain curators to actually dialogue with us in which to talk about our work. Mm-hmm. So there were 30 curators and 30 artists.
30 curators?
Well, 30 writers, 30 writers per se, who are now, some of them are curators, some of them still write, that kind of thing, and some of them are working independently. I had Chris Franklin Sermans, and he's now over at LACMA. But Franklin came to my studio, and he was sort of that introduction to me, in the process to being a part of, freestyle itself. But what was interesting was, the way Franklin came in, he saw the work. We talked about everything but the work, which was awesome. And then he was able to write his essay, and his essay, to this day, I use it wherever I can because I love the essay.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in terms of, I guess I'm skating away from your question a little bit, but... is it what you're asking? Is it more like the idea of where we thought we would end up, or
no? My question is, you were sort of in one way, you were kind of arbitrarily, not completely, but a little bit, you know, you're sort of thrown together with this group.
Okay.
And I guess my question is, other than the post-black sort of nomenclature that we talked a little bit about, do you see sort of an inherent interconnectedness between you? Maybe is something that maybe was kind of a little hazy or vague at the time, and maybe that's grown into something, you know, through the relationships over time. You know, you see, does that make sense?
I guess it does. I mean, it's like we didn't know where we were, who we were. A lot of us didn't know each other. Some people knew who each other were, but most of us did not know each other.
Yeah.
So we were coming together for the first time.
Right.
And we were all in the same boat in terms of, you know, the reviews that began to come out in Art in America, or the reviews that came out in the New York Times, or just the level of, you know, attention that the show was giving, which was obviously the workings of, you know, both Thelma Golden and Christine Kim in terms of the idea of what they were coming up with.
Right.
And they also did the visits themselves. So I kind of found that there is a way in terms of us coming together, but where we've grown to is where we stepped off that stone and we moved into different directions in the context of the art world.
Yeah.
And some of us are in a different, you know, different levels. But what I think was the common denominator for all of us is we didn't expect it. We had no idea that this is how it was going to be presented.
Right.
You know, to be told you're in a community show, but not necessarily told specifics about who you're going to be meeting and who you're going to, you know, these kind of things. It was exciting. I mean, it ended up on Charlie Rose. I mean, Sanford Biggers and Adia Millett, Thelma Golden and Christine Kim were interviewed by Charlie Rose. So it became like a phenomenon that grew bigger and bigger.
Right, right.
You know, so.
Do you think in retrospect, or maybe you specifically know, whether the curators were, in whatever way that they could, actually planning for this sort of big breakout?
I think they were gonna. They knew the details, but they didn't fill us in on them,
right,
which I like.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think they had an idea in terms of what their plans were. Doesn't necessarily everything you plan is exactly how it's going to turn out. So I think there was a plan, but I don't think it was a plan that was necessary. It was a plan to say, here's an inaugural show. Here's an important show that we'd like to present. Here's here's a new idea in terms of the fabric of what you would see in identity politics or political-based work that deals with the idea of blackness. So it was post-Kara Walker, post-Glenn Ligon, post-Lorna Simpson. You know, it was post that. So that was part of this conversation where different artists were going to be dealing in different themes. And so that became a developmental factor that ended up happening towards when I then applied for the City Museum's residency program, which they choose three artists, they give them a stipend and give them a space in which to work, and then present them again in the New York art scene. So it's a huge community. In fact, when you go back to Studio Museum for a show, it's like a family reunion.
Right.
It just feels that way. And you meet everybody from the context of the art world. But what's interesting is when you go outside of that fabric and move into another space and go there, sometimes you don't get, it's not the same vibe at all. Everyone's very competitive.
It's a horrible vibe.
It can be a horrible vibe.
Why can't the rest of the art world be like that?
Yeah, you'd want that. I mean, you'd want that feel to it. But that's how I feel in terms of going back to the Studio Museum. I see it as a home.
Right.
It's a place that I...
Well, something interesting you said that kind of begged a question for me when you described the post, these people, it begged a question for me. Was there a point when you were going through school or even out of school where you felt like you maybe needed to honor that dialogue or that approach to work at all? Or did you feel like, no, I don't need, you know, I can do whatever I want.
I can do anything I want. And in fact, the Studio Museum encouraged that, to do anything you want. The idea is to expand your mind with the different ideas. So at that particular time, when I was in the residency, Larry Stokes Sims was there. And I remember she brought us all downstairs, all three of us downstairs, to the meeting that they usually have in the mornings. And she presented us and she said, do what you want to do. This is a place for you to do what you want to do.
Right.
You know, don't blow up the place. You know, don't set it afire. But, you know, please know that you need to be able to keep your mind open and fresh and be able to do the kind of things you want to do. So that was encouraging.
Right.
Really encouraging.
For lack of a more grand description, a lot of the projects that you've done focus on a particular artist, male artist. You mentioned, you know, Bacon. And then there's Picasso and King William, who you have up right now. Were you doing any sort of approach like that when you were doing the work at that time in 2001?
In 2001, I was looking at zines and comic books. And I wanted to tell the story of my experiences in my life, as well as friends' experiences, through the idea of a zine quality. So it came part of this idea, which I've been doing, which is called Random Select, which is randomly selecting specifics and then selectively putting them together.
How do you randomly select?
Well, you know, it's based a lot on sometimes who I like, and it's what I want to do in terms of the choice, but the random aspect comes to who I team it up with and what I sort of do in terms of that idea of a project. So it helps me to kind of think outside the box in terms of looking at Thornton Wilder's play and then looking at Bill Traylor and kind of combining that story into the conversation. So it's a transformation that helps in terms of just knowing where I want to go with the process. So it makes sense that, you know, I'm here where I am at right now, where I'm working, where I'm just dealing with just John William Johnson, that I'm just sort of working through these ideas of just trying to figure out where I want to tell the story. But in this case, dealing with the direct text of Truth Be Told and Homecoming.
It seems like, you were saying, you mentioned these examples where you're combining, you know, one artist or playwright or what have you, you know, combining these two together sort of in a conversation. But it seems that with this William Johnson subject, his story is so sort of, you know, complicated and grandiose that it was kind of, is that kind of the case that you didn't really need to put him in dialogue with anything else?
In this case, I kind of kept it simple. I never knew who William H. Johnson was until 1996, when my mother sent me a postcard of Moon Over Harlem. And at the time when I was at Skowhegan, I was going through like this frustrating time. It's like when you're a new artist there and then you're meeting professional bass artists who are giving you critiques. And it was hard for me because at that time I was doing very Basquiat kind of work. And it was directly like me kicking the book open and looking at a Basquiat and then recontextualizing an image from Basquiat, but then counterpointing it with another image. But for them, it felt too Basquiat. And I was having a frustrating time because I wasn't sure where I needed to go. So my mother wrote on about, I actually had called her and I was talking to her about what I was feeling. And I said, you know, I kind of feel like I want to come home because I don't know what I'm doing exactly. Because I'm in the early stages of becoming an artist. And I'm just beginning to understand the vernacular and understand the relationship of how one works and that whole system. And it was, she wrote on the back of the postcard, "To thine own self be true." So that it was just the idea, just be what you, do what you want to do. Not worry about sort of the detractors who sort of have an idea of what they want to see. And in most cases, this, from the young artists, they always want to see their hand so quickly. And I always feel like there's a developmental factor that happens with one's hand. Until, you know, if you think about painters painting, for example, most of those artists were in their 50s and 60s when they got their first solo shows. And I think that there's something exciting about that idea of becoming that process. You know, Jack Close said that he was doing de Koonings before he was doing anything to do with the kind of paintings that he did. So I think there's a process of learning through the act of actual mark making, which can be the idea of through appropriation. But it's a way of how you can tweak it and sort of play it so it kind of has its ring of some familiarity, but at the same time, it can be also something that is completely different from what you may have thought you would see if you were coming to go see a works by the idea of a particular artist, who, whether it be Picasso, or whether it be Francis Bacon, or whether it be William H. Johnson, or Bill Traylor, so, or Jean-Michel Basquiat. So it's just that same thing of just sort of looking through and just, you know, looking at the work in such a way that you're dissecting it and trying to create it into your own vocabulary.
Well, you mentioned Basquiat, and you have at least a couple pieces in this show that are more Basquiat appropriations, right? As opposed to maybe what you were doing when you were sort of starting out, which was maybe more you were trying to kind of inhabit him or imitate him.
Right.
So what is his legacy, or what was his legacy for you, you know, in terms of inspiration or what have you?
For me, Basquiat at the time and then even now is the experience of New York. He is that inconsequential part of New York. And what was happening around that time in the 70s, where everything was dilapidated. It was like block by block by block. It was like a bomb out. And I lived in a neighborhood when West 36th Street and Coney Island, where that was the level where things kind of went. And the one section of where we lived, there was Seagate. and then the next was a gated community, and then next was our block, which was at the time predominantly Hasidic. And from there, it transformed over to be more Puerto Rican, Korean, Black, you name it, a mix of people coming into the community and living. Basquiat for me was this idea of thinking through ideas and then basically going through the process of what he was doing with dealing with issues of the diaspora and also dealing with the issues of what is Black, considering that was his Blackness. And he's the first. And he's the first who transformed into the mainstream art world and became part of that inconsequential, you know, crown in that conversation. So in a lot of ways, the crowning of King William is that same thing in the idea of either Keith Haring's crown or the idea of Jean-Michel Basquiat's crown in that idea. But the crown itself also came from the Latin Kings. Latin Kings were a notorious gang that are still notorious in Los Angeles and in Chicago. But at the time in the 70s, when they were there in New York, there was a sort of quick crown that was drawn and then L.A. next to it. Mm. So it was sort of that sort of reminded me. That's when I first came to Basquiat, was when I was in college. It was to see that. And in fact, the first time coming to Basquiat was when I was in high school. I had a teacher who said, "Do I know who Jean-Michel Basquiat is?" And this is around the time that he died. And I said, "No." And she said, "There's some similarities in some of your drawings that look very Basquiat. Have you thought about that?" But I felt that that was more New York because of all the graffiti and all the marks makings and the tags and everything that you saw, which was everywhere. And then the, you know, New York was so harsh and rough. I mean, the closest you get to the conversation in terms of Basquiat is Downtown 81 in the movie where they kind of show him walking through the city of New York, or New York Beat, which is another film that came out in the 1970s that kind of dealt with that kind of feel of New York and kind of, you know, where it was at that particular time and how the art scene kind of blossomed mm-hmm. from there. So for me, Basquiat is so New York. And that's why I attracted to him right away when I first saw his work. And I first came to the work through his journals, in fact. And they were journals mm-hmm. that had writings in them and also had drawings. And the Contemporary Museum in Chicago, at the time I was going to school at Columbia College in Chicago, and I was working with Hollis Siegler and MacArthur Binion, and I was able to get a copy of that particular book. And I just loved it. I fell in love with the writings and then the relationship of what he was sort of contextualizing in terms of the idea of African existence. You know, playing with Da Vinci, you know, everything that he kind of played with mm-hmm. and he sampled from. I mean, some of your greatest artists are samplers. And the you know, Picasso's a master sampler. And I think in a book called The Picasso Papers by Rosalind Krauss, in the book it goes into the details about the idea of appropriation and what happens in that ability to be the master thief. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's kind of looking at that idea. But in my developmental pattern of trying to figure out ideas for the imagery of the work is to be a thief, but at the same time give homage to what it is that I'm actually doing. It's not just the idea of just ripping it off and then just sort of proclaiming it as my own. It's the idea of getting the research and going through the readings, if there's any books, catalogs, anything to read,
right,
to sort of get an idea about this person or even talk to the person. I had a chance to talk to Jean-Michel Basquiat's girlfriend, Susan Mullock, and
how many? He only had one girlfriend?
Well, he had a number of girlfriends, but uh-huh. I got to talk to her. She's a psychologist in New York City now, and she was very informative in telling me, you know, what the reality was. She said he was bipolar. She said he had problems, and there were things that were loud and clear in that experience. And she wondered why, you know, I was so kind of, was I obsessed with Jean-Michel? And I said, "I'm not obsessed. I just wanted to ask you a few questions. A friend of a friend got me in contact with her." But she kind of filled me in on some of the instances. And then there was also people who did know him, like Fab Five Freddy and my teacher, MacArthur Binion. And they knew him. They knew him in a different light than what is kind of proclaimed. And I think Quick Killing in Art, which was done by Phoebe Hoban, that goes into the details. I kind of think that there's something revealed in that part of the book where she talks about it's Christmas time and he's in Vienna. And he's worried about coming downstairs to be with the family because he hadn't had time to get Christmas gifts for everybody. So he's feeling bad about that. That's sort of that tender moment feel, you know, to mm-hmm. the idea of looking in at an artist. So I kind of think about these ideas as a way of being able to talk about
that. Well, what is the, in your mind, the popular conception, you know, in advance of the, tender moment is that he was a big sort of big personality, kind of big ego.
You know, drug addict, you know, that kind of thing, which I think is a big misjustice, because if you look at the work, you're not able to do, especially the show that Kelly Jones and Franklin Sermans did at the Brooklyn Museum. When you look at this suite of drawings, when you go into this one section of the room where they had installed these beautiful suites of drawings, it's like there's no way this mind is constantly just drugged out and doing paintings. It's not that way at all.
Right.
They're very technically excellent, and they're very peculiar, but at the same time brilliant in the draftsmanship. It's just unbelievable.
Do you think maybe that this show you have up now, The Provenance and Crowning of King William, do you think, in a sense, it occurred to me, maybe Basquiat was the crowning that King William did not get?
True. In a way, that's true. He didn't get the crowning that he deserved. And in the act of me doing this work, I'm kind of thinking about that idea of if William H. Johnson would have lived in a different time, if he lived in a time of Basquiat, or if he lived in a time now, what would be his experience? Would it be the same situation, or would it be something completely different?
Yeah.
And obviously, I think it would be something completely different. But I think what I like about this idea is that I'm looking at some early formative years as a way of being able to tell about the conversation. Like, we talked a little bit about the mark making. I think back to when we were living in Coney Island, there was this rabbi who lived down in the basement of our apartment complex. And we had like a 10-story apartment complex, and basically he lived downstairs in the basement, but he got us kids to come in and take a look at the Torahs that he had. He had four different separate Torahs, which was amazing, because it was like he wasn't supposed to be showing us this stuff, but it was that thing. It was like we were his captive audience, and he was trying to explain to us the history of the Torahs. I couldn't understand everything. I couldn't understand the markings. I understand sort of about the idea of following the piece down, and I almost see that when I'm working, I lay things down in the same way.
Mm.
So it's almost a weird thing, including working with the scrolls or working with the big panels or working on just paper, the idea of laying down, and then how I make these marks that go across the piece.
Yeah, it sounds like that was a seminal moment.
Absolutely.
Because you're now doing and have been doing these abstract sort of textual, you know, patterns, language, fictional language, and the Hebrew certainly was in there a little bit.
It informs. It definitely informs. And I think it's important. I think it's important to any of the process. And I think there's a way of seeing things in such a way. And these Torahs were millions of dollars. And I always wondered, I think back now, I have friends who explained to me the relationship of the importance of the Torah and sort of, you know, how expensive it is and how could he have had four of them? And it was a weird thing. Was it that he had left his people to go into, you know, what was the process in which he was?
Yeah.
I mean, to our parents, he was a little touched, but to us kids, he was amazing because he was telling us all these stories, and he would talk a lot about Israel and then the disconnection that he had with Israel, and I thought that was interesting to kind of hear. I think back to that now, and I'm like, wow, that's really important in this process of what I'm thinking about in terms of even the research.
So you are from Canada originally, and you came to New York, but there was this sort of back, and we talked about this earlier, you came when you were a kid, and then and part of that childhood in New York was Coney Island, or was the whole time in Coney Island?
The whole time in Coney Island,
right. Yeah. And how long were you there?
In Coney Island from 1972 to 1980. So
oh, okay.
8 years.
Okay, 8 years. Yeah. But then you went back briefly to Canada.
We went back to Canada, yeah. My mother wanted, at that time, New York was such a mess. The school systems were a mess. And
the subways were a mess.
And the subways were a mess, absolute.
Yeah.
So, but it was either you sent your kid to Catholic school or you try to get them in a better situation. And my mother thought the better situation would be to go to Canada and to basically get us, you know, high school and part of college if we could there.
Yeah.
But so there, as I went to a private school called Rosser Lake College up in Canada, just north of Toronto, probably about 2 hours north of Toronto. And basically, that's when I first learned about art making. And we did things from stained glass, ceramics, painting, that kind of thing. We had a teacher named Mr. Bellina, who was just very interesting in terms of what he presented as ideas towards being able to work out, you know, the idea. He didn't just want us to be drawing and painting. He wanted us to sort of see every aspect. So there was a kiln, and there was the glassmaking section that we had in the small studio area that we worked.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a great experience because it got me thinking about, you know, work. And then when I decided to come stateside, I decided to go to Columbia College in Chicago.
How did you choose that place?
I had some friends, the Hollins family, who were from there originally. They turned out the husband, Mr. Hollins, he was a draft dodger, and he had lived in Canada, and they were moving back to the United States, and they moved back to Chicago. They moved back to Chicago, and they took me on a trip down to Chicago, and I just loved it. And I looked at the Art Institute; it was too expensive, so it just made sense to kind of look at another school. And there was Columbia College, which basically seemed like very much a commuter type school, but at the same time, it opened up so many different avenues, and we got to work with such amazing people within that school itself. It just has these phenomenal people who are in the movie world, who were actually, I started off when I went there, I wanted to be a screenwriter. And then I shifted from there, and I fell in love with the 10th floor of the Wabash building, in which there was the smell of wood and smell of paint. And I remember Hollis Siegler saw me kind of wandering around, and she invited me into her class to take a look. And I just fell in love with it right away.
So this is when you were doing screenwriting, and all of a sudden you discover this building.
Well, you know, it was indirectly, because what was happening in the Wabash building was the elevator, which would go all the way up to the 10th floor, sometimes would miss floors. So I missed miss 8 and 9 and send you up to the 10th floor, and then you'd have to walk back down. So indirectly, it sounds kind of, you know, fluky, but at the same time, it introduced me to things that I did love to do, and especially when I was in Canada and I was at Rosso. Mm-hmm. So it reminded me of what I liked. And so that's where I just realized that this is what I wanted to do,
right,
is be an artist. And so I took a class called Art in Chicago Now with a teacher named Corey Postalone. And it was just there. That's where we spent 80% of the time in the field and then 20% in the classroom. And we got to go see different artists from Chicago, go to all the, you know, all the museums that are there, galleries, that kind of thing. So he was introducing us to the gallery world and the museum world. So it was that was the indicator that I thought that I wanted to do that. And from there, there was support from a future teacher who came to do a visit there named Stan Whitney. He came and he did a talk at Columbia, and he told me about Skowhegan, and he encouraged me to apply to Skowhegan. And I did, got in, and went to the program. The program was a phenomenal program. There I was able to meet people like Nan Golden, and to meet Jacob Lawrence, Tishan Shu, Jessica Stockholder, just really amazing people. And Jessica Stockholder was from Canada, so that was exciting too. So I kind of got a kinship with her, as well as with Nan Golden. Nan Golden was really great, because when she first saw the work, she's like, she goes, "Oh, this is perfect. You're black, you're female, and you do Basquiat. You'll be amazing in the art world. Have fun." But she was being, you know, facetious, because she was saying, you know, you need to look through the process of what you're doing. And she saw this desk that I had in the studio that had all these papers on top of it. And I was kind of trying to hide those drawings, because I wanted to present the big paintings. And she said, "There's something more interesting about these drawings. And have you looked at David Wojnarowicz? Because you need to look at what he's doing, because that's exciting, and you have some ideas that are coming out of that. Think about that." Mm-hmm. So she opened my mind up to another conversation and taking a look at things, and then she let me take a picture of herself, pick a picture of her. So I thought it was kind of cool, because a friend of mine was loving the Battle of Sexual Dependency book. She was in love with Nan Golden's work, and so I was able to take a picture of her and give it to my friend. So it was an amazing time. It was an amazing time. So.
Do you think it was Skowhegan then that was sort of a springboard to you going to New York, back to New York?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I think it was definitely a springboard. And plus, my teacher, MacArthur Binion, he was encouraging about me going to New York. My mother was living in New York at the time. She was working as a nurse in Harlem Hospital. And I think that was, you know, important to being able to define, you know, what it would be like to be an artist in New York City. And what would that experience be like? So
your mom was already back in the city.
Yeah, she was already back in the city.
That made it kind of easy. I mean, it sounds like
it made it easy, because I had a place to stay, and you know,
was she living in Harlem?
She was living in Harlem at the time, and I wouldn't have to pay rent. So I had that, we actually only had a one bedroom apartment at the time, and she gave up her bedroom and moved out into the dining living room area, and kind of set up like a screen and a bed area for herself. And then in the space that I worked in, I ended up making a studio / where I slept. So since then we have now a two bedroom, but it's just that was an important time, because all my friends at the time who were coming out of graduate school were getting studios in Williamsburg, and you know, it just seemed that it was turning into a bit of an MFA ghetto. And it was just, it was questionable about how, you know, what was happening in that transition of Williamsburg in terms of artists trying to figure out what they wanted to do. Everyone had a big studio, but at the same time, the work, this, they weren't feeling like they were working. But I felt like I felt more intimate with the being able to be in that small space. I had never invited people over until Christine Kim came over. And I think that changed, you know, the whole process for, you know, thinking about what we were talking about earlier, which was this idea of how to work, you know, doing the best with what you have.
Right.
And not worrying about sort of logistics that are supposed to portray you as getting the large, massive studio and holding the long Matisse stick and drawing. You know what I mean? It's just, it pushes things a little bit, you know.
Well, yeah, and it's really interesting what we were talking about before we started, which was we were talking about the Manhattan being sort of prohibitively expensive.
Right.
And how a lot of people, artists that you know, have basically left.
Right.
So
artists and curators have left, and they're making a transition to other pastures. Some going to the South, some coming here to Los Angeles, Chicago, you name it. They're just...
So even the outer boroughs are just not enough.
The outer boroughs aren't enough, and the expansion of where, you know, design has pushed things out of the way. Design is really pushing things and pushing people out, and it's becoming its own corporate entity, which is pushing out, you know, your idea of the artist who paints and draws and that kind of thing.
Right.
And I think that's a mistake, because I think that there's something vital about knowing these artists who had come before and hearing their story. And I even think even around the time of Freestyle, it was a transition on youngness, on the idea of young and getting it quick and getting it young as you are. I think about Richard Serra's comment that he made, which was he felt that artists right now were being chewed up and spit up like by kernels by the collectors. And he said they need to be prepared for the process of what it is to become an artist and what that means and how to defending your work, like he's defending Tilted Arc. So I kind of think, I think that's just as important to the process of how you kind of figure out, you know, what you're going to do and how you're going to do it, but do it the best you can. I had a chance to do a Saturday morning class with some students from Tyler School of Art in Philadelphia, and they all talked about how they were going to stay in Philly or they were going to go back to where they came from and do the kind of art they wanted to make because they didn't see a vision to be able to come to New York. They couldn't afford it. It didn't make sense to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, you know, we had talked before a little bit about an article that came out in Huffington Post. I believe it's the Huffington Post, in which they wrote, for now, art would be a place to be seen in New York, but not made. So that's that conversation of just trying to see this, what's happening in terms of, you know, looking at other places, and other places are being a little more informative. Like I was making mention to a friend about, you know, going to an opening in New York or going to an opening in L.A. When you come to L.A., you get a very direct conversation, educational-based dialogue, which is about talking about the work. When you're in New York, the conversation is, how much is this? And what are you doing next? You know, it's like you just finished doing a 2-year project. Now you're showing it in the New York gallery, but it's like, what are you doing next? So that can be a little frustrating. I don't want to come down on New York, but it's hard right now. It's hard for a lot of artists right now, and they're trying to. A lot of artists are regrouping and figuring out what they need to do, and some of them are realizing they need to leave.
Does it feel a little bit lonely now?
It does. It feels
ironically.
Really, ironically, it does feel lonely. Yeah. I ran into some friends recently. I ran into artist Jeff Sunhouse, and he was a little disheveled a little bit in terms of our conversation. We were both trying to feel each other. We hugged each other longer than we would have, and I think it's just that feeling of, you know, what's happened. You know, the great curators we worked with, which were Christine Kim, Brooke Anderson from the Folk Art Museum, you have Franklin Sermans, you have a number of different great curators, Laurie Furstenberg over at LAX, LAX Art. She's there. I mean, they were all from New York, and we knew them, and they were very, you know, positive in the process of what happens. They were the true developmental. Now that we've lost some, we haven't lost them, but they've gone other places. You can't call them to have that dialogue as you did, because it's a different kind of dynamic now. But there was something about that time between, I'd say, 2001. I only say 2001 because that's when I got started, and between 2000 and about 2007, 2008, where the bubble was growing bigger and bigger and bigger, and you had MFA students at the art fairs. You know, it was just, you know, presenting an MFA show at an art fair, just seems a little weird.
Yeah.
And so it just, this transformation just seemed, you know, unbelievable in terms of what was happening.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're missed. They're sorely missed. And you want to see what's going to happen from this. I'm wanting to see what the fallout's going to be.
Well, later on, as in next year, you have a show at the Drawing Center.
Right.
So because that's not really a gallery, hopefully the conversations there will not be how much. And what are you doing next?
It's never there. The Drawing Center is amazing. I think the Drawing Center is just phenomenal in terms of the dialogue. I did a conversation with a number of different artists, and we had a dialogue about drawing and the place of drawing. And Ryan McGinnis was one of the artists, was on the panel, and he was talking about technology and drawing, which I think can work hand in hand. But the majority of the conversation from the audience was, why are you neglecting this idea of the ability to do pure drawing, and what will be the developmental factors that will happen with the Drawing Center, since now they've expanded and they're going to be owning their own building and they're making all these new ideas that they're going to be presenting as a project. I'm working with Claire Gilman on this project, and it's exciting in terms of what we're thinking about in terms of the idea of the project. And it just seems that there is still those vested interests of spaces like the Drawing Center, like the Studio Museum of Harlem, like the law of the nonprofits, that are basically still keeping in form with the relationship of good art.
Mm-hmm.
And the commercial end of it becomes this weird kind of bubble that doesn't encapsulate all the details that are included in the idea of what it is to be making art in New York or making art anywhere.
Is the work that's going to be in the show a combination of older and new, or do you know?
The work for the show that I'm working on is, I kind of don't want to talk about it just yet, but it basically is going to be another artist and another artist in the conversations with each other.
So you're going to make all new work for it?
Right, brand new work, yeah.
Got it. Well, so the provenance and crowning of King William, people will probably listen to this, you know, when the show is up or maybe even after it's over, but it's opening tomorrow. So are you looking forward to that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm interested in hearing what people have to say and kind of get some feedback. And
right.
I get to learn a lot as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a really great show, and you know, I hope it's a good opening and has a good run.
Thank you.
Thank you for talking to me, Deborah.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it, Michael.
Yeah. And we're out.
Right on.